Good afternoon. It is 12:02 Monday afternoon. I almost said Monday morning, but Monday afternoon. I'm Eric Scott. Hello there. It's Monday. That means our regular guest is Chief Dean Rondo, the Wolfboro Police Department.
Woohoo! Chief,
as always, fantastic to have you here. We thought we'd do
something
a little different today. We were listening to Jack as he was on his show a little earlier here in WASR. And they were talking about Afghanistan and how both President Trump and President Biden seem to agree on the fact that we should get our troops out of there sooner rather than later. And I was thinking about that going, now that's interesting, because you don't see that kind of bipartisan agreement very often, especially on something like a war. It's like, all right. And then I started thinking, you know how you go down these rabbit holes. Well, okay. Why did we go in the first place? Why didn't we leave after we get bin Laden? What would happen if we left? Should we leave? And for all of these questions and more, I saved them all up for Chief Rondo because while he has not been in Afghanistan, you were in Iraq
and Kosovo.
So you understand the concepts of these
all too well
tribal infighting,
well.
I guess is the better word. And let's get out in front of anything. This is not because most of these people happen to be Muslims. This is not a bash Islam session.
No, it's not.
I don't particularly care what their religion is, only the fact that they're running around killing each other and killing Americans. That's what I care about. So let's start with the beginning.
Yep.
Why are we there? Ostensibly, we went there to get bin Laden.
We did, yeah.
Didn't we learn that the Russians got harassed out of there? I mean, didn't anybody go, remember that? Wasn't that long ago?
So it's funny you say that because there's a certain amount of hubris, I think. And I'm reminded of Caesar crossing the Rubicon from Shakespeare. The die is cast, right? And
high school flashbacks. Oh god.
I know. So here's the bottom line. We're American. We can do anything, right? I mean, I think that's the prevailing attitude that we're successful. We put a man on the moon, so therefore we'll be successful. And that's the first piece that I think we really have to reconcile, especially now in the 21st century. And I was one of these guys on the ground. I was a major at the time when we decided to invade Afghanistan. I volunteered, and I got sent to Kosovo. I had just finished Albanian language school. So they said, hey, not so fast, slick, you're going to Kosovo. And that was good. That was an eye-opening experience for me. So just to let's take it back to 2001. We have Osama bin Laden, and he was Wasabi, right? He was part of the Wasabi sect. Which is part of Sunniism, right? There's two basically main sects within sects, right? Sects, right? Meaning a part of. Okay, so there's two main sects of Islam, right? You have Sunniism and you have Shiaism. The Sunnis happen to be a bit more secular and progressive, and the Shiites have a tendency to be bit more traditional.
So it's a lot like Judaism with Orthodox Jews and Reform Jews.
Similar.
Or different churches
similar.
That have different beliefs. Okay.
That's similar, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that I use the word secular, and some people may not know what that means. So secular means that there's a more of a separation between, for lack of a better term, church and state or religion and state, okay? So secular happens to be a bit more modern, a bit more progressive, if you will. And a vast majority of the nations that in the Middle East are secular. There are some that are not. A vast majority of, you know, they follow me now, a vast majority of Muslims are Shia by about 80%. Okay. So 80% are Shia, 20% are Sunni, but a vast majority of the nations are secular, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
And I'll explain why in a little bit, because there's a very logical reason why. But moving on, so just so we have a historical foundation, so Islam was started by Muhammad, and I'm not going to go into, you know, how he became enlightened, but he and Islam is means in Arabic, it's surrender to the will of God, right, or submission to the will of God, okay, depending on your dialect and how you want to interpret that. So he spread Islam through essentially the point of a sword, and then you had when Muhammad died, he had no sons, so you had a division in the faith between his son-in-law Ali, who said, "Hey, wait, Muhammad said I was the guy," and then you had Muhammad's followers, other followers, his council that said, "Hey, Ali, you know, hey, no, you know, you're not going to get it today. Maybe sometime in the future, we'll hand you the scepter, and you can be the, you know, the grand poobah, so to speak. But right now, we're gonna give it to somebody else." And this happened two or three times, and Ali kept getting passed over, essentially for promotion, if you will, and then eventually. They gave it to Ali, but they didn't like the way Ali was running things, so they had him murdered. And that became the division. That's when the division occurred, because Ali's followers were very angry that happened. And Ali was a traditionalist, as opposed to the other holy men or the council, the caliphates, who were more pragmatic and more secular in their progressiveness. And so that became the split between the Sunni and the Shia. So that's essentially where you have it. All right. Now that was very, please understand, folks, that was very broad. That's a very broad explanation, because we could literally spend the next year talking about the divisions and the differences between Sunniism and Shiaism, and I'm not willing to go down into that level of grassroots, but I just want to give a broad explanation. So the divisions between these two, though they seem relatively minor, are actually pretty significant. They're huge, to the point where there's open warfare between the Sunni and the Shia all the time. And so Islam is a very fragmented religion, you know, in similar respects, much like Christianity, only much more violent, much more violent. And I'm sorry, that's just a fact. So moving forward, the Ottoman Empire grows up as a result of the caliphate and Sunniism, and they began expanding, and at one point they expanded all through the Saudi Arabian Empire, all through Afghanistan, all through Southern Europe, all the way to the gates of Vienna before they were finally defeated, right? So this was the Muslim conquest of all of the Middle East, essentially, and all the way to the gates of Vienna. So all through Southern Europe and into Western Europe, or parts of Western Europe. The Ottoman Empire was defeated in World War I. They were allied with the Germans in Austro-Hungarian Empire in World War I. As a result of the defeat of those powers, the Axis powers, the Ottoman Empire was divided. Turkey became a country under Ataturk, right? Ataturk is Father Turk, right? And he was a very progressive modernist who made a lot of great changes for Turkey. Very good leader. But the rest of the Middle East was carved up by essentially the British and the French. And that's where you got, and going, this is where I'm going to go back to under Wilson, President Wilson, we see, and everybody hailed Wilson for a great peacemaker and so forth. And unfortunately, he was anything but. What he did is he kicked the can down the road, and we create, this is where you see the creation of these compilation countries, like Yugoslavia, for example. Okay,
and, or Czechoslovakia,
right, and Czechoslovakia and Iraq and a number of these other compilation countries. So Iraq was Mesopotamia, right, and it was under the control of the Ottoman Empire. Iraq is a compilation country. You have three or four different ethnic groups that make up a large portion of Iraq, and then some other minor ones and some minority groups. In Afghanistan, though Afghanistan was never really a homogeneous group country, right? That's something else we have to come to grips with. Afghanistan is a chunk of land that has literally been the doormat in the Middle East for thousands of years. I think that at last count, there was 19 different groups vying for power in Afghanistan, and that is, you have to understand, That is very, very important, because that's too many groups to try to deal with. They're not all homogeneous. Some are related, some aren't. They're completely different ethnicities. Okay, you have Indo-Europeans interacting with Arabs and others. Okay, and none of these groups are seemingly connected, other than by maybe language in some instances. Sometimes not, most of the times not, and sometimes through religion, and sometimes not. Again, you have Sunniism and Shiaism, okay? And the two are really vastly different, okay? And anybody that tells you anything else is just, they're wrong. They're just wrong. So there's a lot of division in Afghanistan, and that's the point I'm trying to get to. So let's talk a little bit about the United States in 2001, right? We have a strong military power, and you know, we're at the top of the economic food chain, and we're very altruistic, right? I mean, we're a very generous country, and because of that, because it's our nature to look to address problems, I think we look to address long-term solutions. So this is the first I became somewhat problematic in the Army, because now I'm at the right rank where I'm weighing in on policy and decisions, and I'm the guy in the back on. I agree that Afghanistan was always the prize after 9/11. You had to go in. We had to remove Osama bin Laden. We had to deal with Al Qaeda. It had to be a heavy-handed approach. I mean, I'm sorry, they killed 3,000 persons, many of whom were American citizens. Okay, and mostly civilians, if not all civilians. And that was really wrong. Right? They've been attacking. It's not the first time they attacked the World Trade Center. They had just bombed the Cole, the USS Cole, in, I believe it was Yemen. There was a number of attacks. The embassy in Nairobi. There was a couple of other embassies that were bombed in the African continent. I can't remember all of them now. But this was the first big attack. So they've made it their mission to kill Americans. And ostensibly it goes back to the reason why Osama bin Laden took exception to the United States. What caused this hatred is that we set foot in Saudi Arabia in 1991 to help expel the Iraqi government that had taken Kuwait and had plans on taking large swaths of Saudi Arabia, ostensibly for oil purposes. And Osama bin Laden felt that we were infidels and that we shouldn't be setting foot in the Holy Lands that he considered all of Saudi Arabia. If you remember correctly, we launched the invasion from Saudi Arabia. So we always blamed the United States for that. And he himself wanted to expel the Iraq government through Wahhabism and his Wahhabi followers. And quite frankly, that may have been a noble goal and passion of his, but he simply didn't have the military might to do so. So Saudi Arabia invited in the United States, and he got mad at Saudi Arabia for that, and then started making war in Saudi Arabia, and the princes and so forth in the United States, and that's how we got ourselves in this mess. And then he was expelled from that region of the Middle East, and he took home in Afghanistan, which is essentially a lawless country. I mean, because there's no central government. Government has collapsed, and that's what happens when you have 19 different groups all vying for power.
Is that what they call the failed state?
Yeah, it's a failed state. That is exactly what a failed state would be. And the only time, believe it or not, that Afghanistan was ever a state, there's been caliphates in Afghanistan throughout the course of history. But the only time in my knowledge of the country is when the Soviets conquered the country and set up a government, and that was a fairly homogeneous government, albeit a communist one, and they maintained power only through use of force, which we recognize is bad, but at least it was a government. I mean that's it was a government. Afghanistan after that kind of collapsed. You know, they were aligned with the Soviets after World War II. They did, you know, they were fairly from right about 1950 to I think the Soviets invaded when the country started to fall apart in the mid 70s. The Soviets invaded in 79 or 80, or maybe was it 81? All right, it was in that neighborhood. In any event. But yeah, they were fairly successful from then. I've seen photos of Kabul, the capital, and it's beautiful. It's beautiful. I've seen it. It looks fairly progressive. It looks hot, but fairly progressive, and automobiles and people wearing Western clothing and young women on their way to school with school books under their arm. So it was, you know, they were, I think, doing all the right things in terms of remember, the first job of any government is right protection of its citizens, and that comes in many different forms. You know, compulsory education is one of them. But then you had the two fractions began, or two primary factions began battling each other. And you had tribalism, and you said they're very, very spot on. Absolutely, this is tribalism to its max. This is it. This is the issue. We see the same issue in the Middle East. You see the same issue in Africa. To be quite honest with you, this is really why this is hard. This is why these types of countries that are very tribal in mentality can't get it together. They just can't get it together, and when one power gets in, they oppress they oppress the other minorities, the minority powers.
And those are the countries that Donald Trump had that colorful name for.
Yes, but there's a lot of issues, with this. So let's get back to failed Wilsonian politics, right? I mean, so Iraq is a compilation country, and it should have been formed along different boundaries, and Afghanistan is the same thing. They should have really formed it under different boundaries, and when they divided it up, but they didn't, and there was really I'm not really sure. I understand why they put the boundaries where they did, but I'm not really sure if anybody really gave that any serious thought. And when we do public policy, we have to look at the second and third order effects of your decisions, because they're going to have ramifications. And we're seeing those play out now. And that's why I say Wilson kicked the can down the road. He did a really good job, because he kicked it really far down the road, you know, by about 100 years or so. But we're dealing with it now.
We are talking with Chief Dean Rondo of the Wolfboro Police Department. It's 1222 here in WASR. And if you have a question, query, comment, whatever, 569-5253, 569-5253. So as a layperson, I guess the next question is, okay, we got bin Laden, why didn't we just pick up our football and go home?
We should have. We missed a golden opportunity at that point. And while we're at it, let's talk about Iraq, too, because we missed a golden opportunity, in my opinion, to get out of Iraq really early on. What we should have done, remember, Afghanistan was always the prize, right? Afghanistan, keep your eye on Afghanistan. Keep your eye on the ball, folks. There it is, right? So Afghanistan was always the prize, right? That was the that always should have been the major focus, because we had every moral right, we had every ethical right, we had every moral right in the world to go in and do what we did in Afghanistan. And I think President Bush had it correct when he went in. He went in very limited scope. And that's exactly what we should have done, for a very limited, specific purpose. I'm a big believer in the tenets of air, land, battle doctrine as first espoused by General Colin Powell. And you got to have an exit strategy. When I was in eighth grade, I had an English teacher who was just brilliant. And he said, you want to write the great American novel? And of course I do. He says, you start with the ending first. You write the ending first. So let's go back to Colin Powell here. So you know your end state, right? So whatever we do, right, with goals and objectives, right? So this is my famous goals and objectives speech. Look, you have a goal, and the goal might be something that should be very measurable. Goals are very measurable. They should be easily defined, and they should be achievable.
Let me stop you right there.
Yes.
Vietnamization. There's no way to measure it.
No. You're right. We learned a lot, and so didn't General Powell when he was in Vietnam, because he served as a major. He was the same rank as me when I was in Iraq, in Kosovo, right? And he understood. He's one of the best officers and statesmen this country's ever produced. I wish he would run for president. But he understood it all too well, and you're absolutely correct. So goals and objectives, they have to be measurable, they have to be achievable. You have to be able to have clearly defined objectives that get you to that end state. So, for example, when I was asked years ago to develop goals and objectives for the Wolfboro PD, I did. And somebody said, well, gee, I thought you would have on there. One of them would be the best police department in the state of New Hampshire. Well, that's certainly a commendable goal. That's certainly a laudable goal. How do I do that? How do I measure that? Right. How is that measured? So these got to be clearly defined, right? And they have to be achievable, right? They have to be sustainable. They have to be achievable. So one of the things that I said as a major, when I saw the mission creep, what I call mission creep in Afghanistan, and certainly mission creep in Iraq, and I was involved. I was part of the original invasion. In fact, a couple of days ago was my birthday, the 21st of, or yesterday, the 21st of March was my birthday.
Congratulations.
And, well, thank you. Yeah, looking forward to another 58 years. But I crossed the border of Iraq on my 37th birthday, so many years ago, part of the original invasion force with the 82nd Airborne. I was with a rifle battalion, airborne infantry, right? And we're all paratroopers, right? I crossed the border. It was a major at the time. So, we wanted to remove Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party from power. We wanted to arrest his two sons, Uday and Qusay, and then turn Iraq over to the Iraqi people. Right, those were the objectives. So I would say that those were some good goals, right, or objectives. But where it began to go south is we decided, and I know exactly who is responsible for this, but we decided that we needed to give them a democracy. And I was one of the guys on the ground saying, stop with the democracy piece. Stop with we have to rebuild their society. Why is that incumbent upon the U.S. taxpayer to do that? We shouldn't be doing that, because now you're taking what should be an 18-month mission and turning it into a 10-year occupation, and neither of which are really going to be well looked at. So we shouldn't do this. We should get in, we do what we need to do, and then get out. and I was always that guy. And as a result of that, I was very, you know, and I said, I didn't make a lot of friends over there. And basically, oh, you need to shut up and sit down, Major, and get on with the program. And, well, this program ain't working. It ain't going to work. And lo and behold, I'm right. And, of course, I know I was right. I'm always right.
That's why even when you're wrong.
That's why I'm a colonel, right? That's why I was a full-bird colonel, right? You don't get to the rank of full-bird colonel by being wrong. And I saw what was I did two tours in Iraq, actually. And the second tour I did as a lieutenant colonel. And I foresaw when my general was asking me on the way out, he said, what do you think is going to happen? I said, well, sir, I'll tell you right now. This is what's going to happen. We're going to end up pulling out of here. And this is before President Obama became president. We're going to end up pulling out of Iraq. We're going to turn this whole thing over to the Iraqis. It's going to result in a civil war. And a strong man's going to emerge. And there's going to be a whole lot of killing that goes on. And then hopefully that one strong man that emerges, hopefully he is benevolent and we can work with him. And I said, but that's what's going to happen. And he, wow, that you're awfully cynical. No, I'm not. I'm not cynical. I'm just, you asked me the question, and I'm telling you that what's going to happen. And the same thing's going to happen in Afghanistan. And with Iraq, I never foresaw the start of ISIS. I never saw that one coming. But then again, that was a whole nother interesting dynamic, and that's a whole nother discussion for a whole nother day. But I still think that you haven't seen the end of Iraq in terms of what's going to happen. They have to really sort this out, and they're not done fighting each other yet. Watch what happens. And that's all I'm going to say. Watch what happens. And the only thing I couldn't put is a timeline on it. I don't know. It all depends on a lot of factors. And still, there's a lot of international pressure on Iraq trying to keep everybody at the negotiating table. And that's the only thing that's been keeping that country together. But sooner or later, that's going to fail. Afghanistan, completely different story. You got a whole bunch of different groups, very tribal in mentality. And they all want to be the governing body. And that's just too many people vying for power, and it's always been like that. You're not changing that dynamic. So we go back to the United States in 2001, where the United States felt that, you know, because of our GDP, because of our economic power, right? We talked about elements of national power here before. You have diplomatic, informational, military, and economic, right? Those are the four elements of national power. That's how nations exercise power. Power projection, right? That's how you make things happen in your national interests for your citizens. That's the goal of every president, right? That should be the goal of every world leader, right? And you see that happening. You certainly see it in China. Right. If you look at China, right, they do everything for the benefit of the Chinese people. What we often miss with China is they're very centralist in their authority. So what they'll say to a particular group, and we see it happening right now, hey, everything we're doing is we're doing for you, but in order for us to help future generations, you have to sacrifice. So that's what's going on in China right now. So there's a whole lot of sacrifices going on. But you look at China. Look at they have inroads into Africa now. They have surpassed us with the largest navy in the world. They're embarking on long range bomber production. They're embarking on creation of super carriers. They're embarking upon a nuclear submarine fleet.
They put a lander on Mars.
So they just put a spacecraft. They went to the moon.
Probably cost a tenth of what ours did.
So the point I'm trying to get at here is that with China is definitely an adversary.
And sure.
For those of us who don't think so, think again. And what we're seeing what I'm noticing is a shift in their from defensive military weapons and platforms to offensive power projection type platforms and foreign policy. There's Silk Roads Initiative, 2049, China Silk Road. to create trade all through the African continent, buying up large tracts of rare minerals and leases to exploit and excavate those rare minerals used in productions of cell phones and, you know, TVs and so forth and so on. Really, really important stuff here. You see them playing very hard in the South China Sea. You see them getting a little frisky with Japan. You see them pushing on Taiwan. So
in the Philippines,
yeah, the Philippines, another one. So they're exerting that. That's called power projection, and that's what they're doing. So let's drive it back to the Middle East.
Isn't it funny when we do it, it's democracy. When they do it,
well they're doing it. You know, well you got to ask yourself, why are they doing it, right? And this is getting back to the national interest.
They're
this is why nations
muscles,
right? They're flexing their muscles because they have a huge population density, and they are consuming. They're huge consumers of products, much more so than the United States. They consume 2.5-3 times the amount of fuel oil that we do.
Well, they have what, triple our population?
Oh, easily,
least,
yeah, yeah,
not,
well over a billion people, well
yeah.
over a billion people. So, but they are hugely consuming resources, and so they've got if they are going to be successful as a nation state, they have to do things that are in their best interest. Right. And these things they have determined are in their best interest. So all nations do things that are in their best interest, not necessarily right. in the best interest of everybody else. The United States is a little different. And say what you will about the United States, we certainly have our own problems. I'm not going to even suggest that we don't. But I really am. Let's face it. The United States is the only country I know that gives away money to foreign countries. Right? We give foreign aid and lots of it, lots of it.
Well, China okay. does too,
and not to the extent that we do.
Right. I don't have numbers, yeah. but
we give far more. We give far more aid, big time foreign aid to the countries than anyone else in the world. We're very altruistic. You know, we share our wealth with the rest of the world. And now some people could poke me in the eye and talk about all the, you know, the ulterior motives for that. And I was like, sure, you know, there is a carrot and stick approach here. You know, we're going to give you, you know, here's the carrot. We're going to give you some money, but we want you to do X or
power.
Y. And there's the stick. And if you don't do that, we're going to take the money away. So, sure, right, we do things. Remember, all nations get to do things in their best interest, right? But I really am leery of a world where we are not at the top of the food chain, so to speak, all right? And I'm very leery of that. Because I think life would be a lot different for the average American if, say, Russia or China were at the top of the food chain and not the United States. And I'll just park that one there and just leave it. But getting back to the Middle East, the issue in Afghanistan is that it's very hard to govern, very hard to control. In fact, the languages are not even the same, right? This is what everybody seems to think. They all speak one language. No, they don't speak one language. They speak about 15 different languages. The average education is the average person is educated over there slightly above first grade level. At least when I was in Iraq, 80% of the people were literate. You don't have that in Afghanistan. And the reason you don't have that is, one, because it's so diverse. It's so fragmented. And they've spent the last, you know, 2,000 years at war, quite honestly. Those were all the issues with Afghanistan. Afghanistan should have always been go in, get the mission done, get out.
Right.
And Iraq, in my opinion, should have been the same. We should have gone in. We should have removed Saddam. You know, let's look at the things we should have done in Iraq. For example, we should have gone in to remove Saddam and his two sons and the Ba'ath Party from power. We did that. We should have. If the issue was ostensibly, if the issue was let's get at weapons of mass destruction, right? If you remember correctly, that was one of the, everybody believed they had weapons of mass destruction. You know, let's get in and let's satisfy to the American people that if yes, they do have weapons of mass destruction, and we remove those or neutralize them, or what we found is that they had weapons of mass destruction, but very few, very limited, not to the scope that we thought of. Okay, fine, then we neutralize those. Or three, satisfy to the American people. Okay, we went in under this purpose that, you know, they were developing or had a weapons of mass destruction program. They didn't have that, or it wasn't as far advanced as we thought, but we neutralized it, we removed it, we eliminated the threat, and the threat is now gone, and we should now withdraw. We're turning over the country to the UN or to the Iraqi people or whatever the case may be. See you later, bye. And we should have done that. And now, and this is where I get to say, We have to, and look, the Democrats have done the same thing, right? So I don't want to make this into a Republican-Democrat thing, but, you know, President Bush should have never really gone into Iraq, right? You should have never done that, okay? There were other options. General Zinni was the Marine Corps general formerly in charge of CENTCOM, that's Central Command. That is the command, Unified Specified Command, that has responsibility for the Middle East. He even advised against it. So first of all, General Zinni is Arab descent, right? He is an American, but he understands the culture, grew up. His ethnicity is Arab. He speaks Arabic. He's a very bright man. He said, General Zinni said, and I happen to agree with him. Hey, no one knew that region better than him. No one knew that region better. He was a bright, bright guy. I love General Zinni. And he said, don't do it. Don't go in. Iraq is going to fall apart all by itself. You give it 18 months. It's going to collapse. And that's what we should have done, right? And we should have looked to those elements that were simmering underneath, picked the best one that we could deal with and support them and hopefully get them to overthrow Saddam. That's what we should have done, but we didn't do that. We decided that we had to go in and remove them by force. Okay. The problem is when you do that, you create second and third order effects because now you create a power vacuum, and that's what we did. That's exactly what we did, and that's exactly a problem you don't want to have put on your doorstep. And I think maybe some of the discussion was with the National Security Council and the NSA, or not NSA, but NSC, is that, well, maybe if we do this right, we can pick who to put in, you know, who do we put on the throne, so to speak. And the problem is we went with some guy by name of Talabi, and I don't know if you're familiar with Talabi or not, but I was in Kabbalah, and oh my God, I almost got killed the day that they announced they were putting Talabi on the throne in Iraq. And I go, you gotta be kidding me. And it should have been somebody that was a favorite son of al-Sistani, who was a religious leader. And this, again, this is funny. This is how little we knew about the region. Now, I knew about the region, but it seems to me that not everybody pays attention in sixth grade. Because I had an army, I was a major, remember, I was a major at the time. I had an army lieutenant colonel, intelligence officer, G2 for a division. When I said, look, we're doing this wrong. We need to get somebody that's friendly with al-Sistani, or, you know, because we knew al-Sistani as a holy man would not have taken the throne, but we could have got one of his proteges to do that. So we, you know, and immediately once you do that, you have 80% of the population. And that was my point. 80% of Iraq is Shia. It's not Sunni, it's Shia. Don't replace, and Talabi's Sunni, don't replace the guy on the throne with a Sunni. You want 80% of that population right away, and you got to go with somebody who's a holy man on that side. And they go, no, we don't want to do that because, you know, he's too close to Iran. No, he's not. No, he's not. No, they're all Arabs. And I said, no, Iranians are Persians. There's a difference. So even in the early days of the wars, we didn't understand the cultural differences between the Arabs and the Persians, Iraq and Iran. We didn't understand the differences between Shiaism and Sunniism. I did, but it seems to me very few policymakers paid any attention. They didn't understand. They didn't understand the divisions in the religion. They didn't understand the short and long term effects that are really poor policy decisions, and that created the mess we ended up with in Iraq and the civil war that we had, and the whole country just came unglued. And that's the same thing that's going on in Afghanistan.
Well, let me ask you then, what I'm trying to think of a good way to put this.
There is no good way to put it.
There, you know, we spent billions of dollars. We sent tens of thousands of men and women over there, some of whom didn't come back, some of whom came back hurt permanently with all kinds of injuries. And what did we accomplish? What did that sacrifice accomplish?
All right, so...
That's
a great question.
I have nothing but the utmost respect for those people, all of you guys who were
that,
over
that's
there.
A great question. So let me answer that objectively. So fear not. Everything you said is true. Fear not. And I know what someone's going to say, nothing. We got nothing. No, that's not true. We actually got quite a bit.
We must have had something, or we wouldn't have left.
We did. We actually accomplished quite a bit, but let's face it, and this is where you have to ask, and this is a rhetorical question, this is a deeply philosophical question, and what I'm about to say is you're going to have to, once I say what we got in return, you're going to have to ask, well, was the juice worth the squeeze? Okay, so your point is very valid. We spent billions and billions and billions of taxpayer money. We sacrificed the cream of American youth in Afghanistan and Iraq and other countries, you know, Yemen and Somalia and various countries and around the world and Africa and so forth. There's been a lot of bloodshed. There's been a lot of collateral damage, right? There's a lot of death and destruction, absolutely, right? All of that. What it did do is the benefit was that we did take a lot of terrorists and bomb makers out of the battle space, either through arrest, capture, or as casualties on the battlefield. All right, it really showcased the incredible military might of the United States and its resolve to stay in the fight for a very long period of time and to take the fight directly to the enemy and, when need be, to kill them in a most horrific fashion. And I say these things not lightly, but what it did is it showed our enemies that we are willing to stay in the fight for as long as it takes. How long have we been in Afghanistan? 14, 15 years?
About that.
Well, actually 19 years. I take it back. It's 2021. Yeah.
Been that long?
Yeah, it's been 19 years. So, or you're getting on, oh, I'm sorry, maybe even just over 20, right? Because 2021, 2001, 19 years. So, in Iraq, 17 years, right? Because we still have troops in Iraq. I mean, for crying out loud, we still have troops in Kosovo.
Well, we have troops in Germany, too, for that matter.
We have troops in Germany, but that's a different discussion. Right. That's a whole other discussion. They're not an occupation force.
True.
And our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan are not occupation forces either, but they're still fighting the fight. They're still fighting the battle. And they're still trying to provide stability at this point. And that's very important.
Well, their opponents regard them as an opposition force.
Our opponents do because you know when you talk about the religion and everything gets back to the religion, you know, occupation is a bad thing, right? But we're there to push back against in Iraq, push back against ISIS and Al Qaeda and Iran, right? Remember, Iran took advantage of this. We just killed General Soleimani in January. We took him out with a drone strike. That was something long overdue. That was actually a very good thing. He was the Iranian general that was responsible for killing thousands of American troops. He was the one that engineered all of the unrest in Iraq, or I should say most of the unrest in Iraq, and then all of the unrest in Syria. So taking that guy out of the battle space is a good thing. That was a good day. But again, this gets back to this showcased America's resolve to say, listen, if you take up arms against the United States, we're gonna stay in this fight until it's done. And that causes our enemies, our adversaries, to take pause, to include Russia, to include China. All right. So, folks, we have some really, really, we have some bad actors out there. We have some bad nation states that wish us harm, and they don't care what political party you are affiliated with. They certainly don't care anything about you. They don't care what race you are, religion, or they don't care if you voted for Biden or for Bernie Sanders. They don't care. All they know is you're an American and they want you dead. And that's just the bottom line. All right. And no, I'm not being cynical. I am an optimist, but I'm very pragmatic. Okay. And I look at things in a very, matter of fact fashion. And I've been all over the world. And folks, believe it or not, even our own allies don't like us that much. Okay.
So I've heard that.
That is true. That is very true. So even some of our own allies really don't like us that well.
And the funny thing is, it's changed within a generation.
Yes, it has.
When we were younger, my father was an airline employee for TWA.
Trans World Airlines.
Yes, beautiful airline.
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic airline. And, of course, we had unlimited flight privileges as long as you flew standby. So we went a lot of places. And I remember I was 12 or 13, my first trip to Paris. And we were treated almost as rock stars. We were Americans. They wanted to practice their English on us and, ask about, the president, who I think was Carter at the time.
Jimmy Carter.
Yeah. I mean, it was great. And now you've got that ugly American stereotype.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's a different world, I guess.
It is a very different world. Yeah.
So what's the answer, with this? I know Biden wants to bring the troops out. So people like me who know absolutely nothing about this. So why don't we just go, okay, out.
So there's some things that are going
to. I'm not advocating that. I'm just asking.
There are some things that are going to.
Why aren't we doing it?
I think with relatively speaking, and President Trump wanted to do the same thing. And I think if you talk to anybody that's as pragmatic as me, former officer that served in the region will tell you, clearly what we're doing right now is not working. And we have to do something else. So now when the reason I think both presidential administrations were reluctant to pull the troops out, as you so said, is because they realized that we've been over there so long providing stability, even though we've made the region unstable. When you pull out the American troops, you're going to create a power vacuum, and it's going to result in more violence. And see, this is the danger that I get back to with when President Bush authorized the invasion of Iraq. This was the ultimate danger, right? We're going to go over there and we're going to get sucked into a 10-year occupation, and we'll never get out of there, because the minute you start pulling troops out, as we saw under President Obama, you created a power vacuum. Okay, and that's exactly what happened. That is exactly what happened. And President Obama was advised, don't do that. This is really a bad time. He did it anyway. And so, yeah, he gets to wear that one. There were better solutions. And we by not backing the Kurds, which could have been a stabilizing force in both regions.
And who were allied
with the United States. That was a huge mistake. That was incredibly bad. I was definitely always supporter of, letting the Kurds actually come further down in Iraq. I wanted to move the red line down to just south of Mosul and have them come down and but I got outvoted on that one. That was in 2008. But I think that would have really solved that problem in northern Iraq. And if we had done that, I think it would have really prevented ISIS from getting the foothold that they did. You know, we have issues with Turkey right now. Turkey is a NATO partner, NATO ally. It's not a very friendly government toward the United States. They've got issues with the Kurds in Kurdistan, and
in Greece.
It's complicated, right? To say it's complicated. I hate to overuse that, like a bad relationship. But you know, this gets back to, you know, President Bush and the neocons. They got this one. This is on them, and they're going to have to live with it. You know, do I think that there was some concern about Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction? Yes, I do. We know from history now that you know, concern was ill-founded. But it doesn't change the fact that we had a concern at that time, because that's what the intelligence was saying, and we had to do something. But that something didn't have to be an invasion, and that was a little drastic to me. Afghanistan was always the prize, but I think Afghanistan should have been a limited intrusion mission. Now, in answer to what we should do, I think with both countries, yeah, I think coming out makes a lot of sense at this point, but I think you just can't come out and say, okay, willy-nilly, where everybody's going back to Fort Hood now. Yeah, I don't think you can do that. I think what you can do is you can do a hybrid model where perhaps we can ring Afghanistan with brigade combat teams and outposts in, say, Uzbekistan and to Turkestan and some of the other stands in the area. And when these targets of opportunity pop up, or we need to do a quick power projection into the country to go after a target that we're, you know, this is clearly a terrorist target, clearly waging war against the United States, that clearly doesn't want to sign a peace treaty with the United States, then we have that combat power forward, and we can, you know, if you will, lay the smackdown on them. And that's what you're doing. I think I see something similar in Iraq. That's really all you can do at this point.
Then we'll never leave.
No, we're stuck there. You're stuck there until you're stuck there. You can't have a power vacuum in that part of the region of the world. It's really a bad idea. And you're stuck there until Iraq figures itself out. And you're stuck there until Afghanistan can come to terms with who they are as a national identity. That's what they're lacking, and they can figure it out. And I don't know if that will ever happen. I do know one thing: if we leave now and the Taliban come back, it's going to be a breeding ground for terrorism all over again.
Yeah, that's true. But on the other hand, the Taliban don't permit drugs either. So,
they grow drugs. They grow opium. That's how they finance themselves.
Right.
They're shipping opium all over the world.
Yeah, so. I don't understand why they, I mean, if there's that many, what do you call them, tribes, for lack of a better term, divide the place into states, everybody gets their own little state, and they can live happily ever after.
Well, I think that's easier said than done, because
I'm sure it is.
It's not that simple, because you don't have these homogeneous areas in one part of Afghanistan. You got them all over the place. You have these little enclaves all over the place, just like Yugoslavia. Okay, that was the issue. That was the issue in Bosnia and Herzegovina and Montenegro and Kosovo. Those were the issues. And those aren't easily solved. And you can't have ethnic cleansing in an area. We know that's bad. So these are the issues. They're complex. They're not easy to be solved. You know, we had a chance in World War, you know, just after World War One in 1919 to do the right thing. And Iraq would have been really simple. Give everything, you know, to the west of Baghdad. Everything goes to the Sunnis. Everything to the south and west goes to the Shia. Everything north goes to the Kurds. And that would have fixed Iraq. That's the way it should have been done, along ethnic lines. So you had Al-Anbar. So, interestingly enough, in the few minutes we have remaining, So when I was over there as Chief of Operations and Intelligence for Brigade Supporting 18th Airborne Corps, you know, I had missions throughout the entire country of Iraq, even had missions in Afghanistan that we were running out of my office. And anyway, the long and short of it is, Alambagh Province was very successful. Marines did a great job in Alambagh Province, right? And one of the reasons that they did such a great job in Alambagh Province is because it was homogeneous. Alambagh Province almost 99% Sunni.
Okay.
All right. So what does that mean? That means that, you know, you got one fuzzy naval that you have to punch, or two at the very most. And meaning that what you do is you find those two dudes that can control 98% of the population, and you put your arm around them and you make them a deal they can't refuse, right? From Don Corleone, right? So the problem with Baghdad was you had, you know, about 15, right? Baghdad is a very fragmented city. You had a Sunni section, you had a Shia section. You know, and oh my God, it was just and it's the same thing in the southern portion where 10th Mountain was and so forth. That was all principally done by Qasar and Basra. That was all principally Sunni, right? So you find the one or two guys all the way north to Karbala. You know, that's why I was very successful in this. I dealt a lot with the Sunnis, or correction, the Shia. And I was very successful there because I found the one or two dudes that I could wrap my arm around and say, hey, man, I need you to throw in with the coalition, you know, and had a meeting, you know, and they were all on board with that. So we were able to placate our areas very quickly, but only because we found the two or three dudes that we could affect very easily, and they brought with them the vast majority of the population.
So they've had to make deals with some pretty nasty guys.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of that. There's always a lot of that. I had to make deals with the Wahhabi, and I did when I was in Baghdad. They were causing my brigade to take a casualty a day. We had to put an end to that. That was too many Americans.
I understand. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, Chief Dean Rondo of the Wolfboro Police Force.
Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the history lesson.
Yep, you're welcome.
And we'll talk next Monday.
Absolutely. Looking forward
to
it.
Okay. News is next. It is 1 o'clock.
How's